Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is singer, songwriter, and musician Jude Johnstone. Born and raised in Maine, Johnstone began playing piano and writing songs around the age of 8. At 18, she was discovered and mentored by E Street saxophonist Clarence Clemons. In 1979, she moved to Los Angeles, where her songs quickly became sought after and then eventually covered by an incredibly impressive list of artists, including Trisha Yearwood, Emmylou Harris, Bonnie Raitt, Stevie Nicks, and Johnny Cash. She released her first CD, Coming of Age, to great acclaim in 2002, and she also released two jazz blues-influenced CDs, Blue Light and Mr. Sun. Her fifth release and her most recent is entitled Quiet Girl. It's a beautiful and intimate collection with many guest artists, including Emmylou Harris and the late Clarence Clemons. And welcome to the show, Jude. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
Now, according to your biography, you began writing songs, as I said, shortly after discovering the piano at age 8. What was it that caught your imagination?
Probably just listening to, you know, my parents and my brothers all had music going all the time, you know, the varied genres in the house too, you know, the Beatles and then Glenn Miller and Sarah Vaughan. You know, my dad was a lot older than my mom, so there was a lot of really early influence for me from that era.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't actually seep into my music until much later. You know, I didn't realize how influenced by it I was, but when I did the Blue Light record, it was kind of like, whoa, where's all this coming from? And I realized it was from my dad's record player.
Uh-huh. Came in from, seeped in through your unconscious.
Yes.
Well, what made you decide to start writing songs?
Well, I don't think I put a lot of thought into it at 8 years old, probably.
Right.
But I was just always a writer. And so even when I didn't play an instrument yet, I was very philosophical and sort of melancholy.
Really?
When I was extremely young. And that's just the way I was, wired, you know? And so writing seemed like the natural thing to do.
And I assume, like so many songwriters, you started out writing poetry. Is that true?
No, I didn't.
No?
No, just went straight on into the groove, you know?
Wow.
I wrote all ballads at first, though. That's, that much is true. You know, when I hooked up with Clarence Clemons, I had sent him a tape, and that was what was on. It was like 11 of the saddest songs written by a 18-year-old that you could have imagined.
I can imagine.
And I did branch out into, like, you know, other kinds of music and groove-oriented things later and jazz. But at first, it was all sad.
Sad ballads. Well, tell us about meeting Clarence Clemons. I that must have been something that totally changed your life.
It absolutely changed my life.
To tell us about how you met.
We met on an airplane. I was just on my way with my cousin to go see what California looked like briefly, and I was 18, and Clarence was sitting near us, and we just struck up a conversation and ended up trading information and, you know, addresses, and he said, gee, send me a tape, you know, sometime. A couple months later, it took me a while to just find a recording studio in the sort of remote area that I lived in, and I found a little place and just put down, you know, 10 or 11 piano vocals, and went ahead and sent them off to him. And he, of course, didn't even remember meeting me. He meets so many people every day. But something compelled him to listen to this tape, you know, in a vast pile of tapes I later saw at his place in Seabright, New Jersey. And I don't know what made him do it, but he did, and he loved it. And he contacted me and said, how soon can he get to New Jersey?
Wow, that must have been an amazing moment for you.
It was dreamlike. And strange, you know.
Oh,
I didn't even know him. And, you know, he was such a lovely man that my parents back in Maine, he thought my parents might be sort of astonished that I was going to leave with this crazy giant black man and go to New Jersey, you know. And so he said, you know, I'll fly to Maine and I'll meet your parents and I'll let them know I'm okay.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm just trying to help you.
That is a magical story.
Yeah.
That really is. Well, so you ended up moving to Los Angeles in 1979, as I said.
I did.
Well, was that culture and whole landscape so different from where you'd come from?
It was night and day.
How did it affect you? I was from a little town in Maine,
you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I was quite naive, and suddenly I was, you know, at the top of Mulholland Drive in California looking out over the city and thinking, this is cool.
Like something out of a movie, right?
Yes, absolutely. It was quite out of body for quite a while.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But how did it affect you as a writer? It's kind of a superficial culture, because I can say that because I'm from there.
Yeah, that's right, you can. Well, you know, I mean, it was exciting and exhilarating, mm-hmm. obviously. It must have affected me in that way. And really, I just had to catch up, you know, because mm-hmm. I was really quite young. And it took me a while to do that and kind of get my bearings, you know. But their producer, Springsteen's producer, lived there, and that was why they wanted me to be there, because they thought he might be able to work with me on my songwriting and just help me meet people, which he did. He was a wonderful man, and is. I had just worked on the songwriting, and he had a beautiful recording studio and a 1901 Steinway. That's still one of the best pianos I've ever played.
Oh, wow. God, Cinderella landed in a new life. That's amazing.
It was bizarre.
Well, I want to play a cut from your current CD, Quiet Girl. This song is called On That Train. Can you tell us a little something about it? It's a beautiful piece.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I wrote On That Train when I was on a camping trip with my daughter's school. I hate camping. And it was in Gaviota
Beach?
Yes, and where the train goes through at night and, you know, shakes all the tents. I've always loved trains. I always take the train to L.A. and back, since I don't drive, and I've got a romantic, you know, thing with trains, as many people do.
Oh, absolutely.
And I needed desperately to escape from being on the camping trip. And so the idea, obviously that's not what the song is about, but the idea, when I heard the train and the whistle at night, it was just so beautiful that it took me away, and I wrote that song.
Okay, let's listen to a bit of it.
The train rolls by and I lie wide awake. The whistle blows and it's so hard to take. Cannot manage to explain. I wish that I was on that train. I said I'd go, I swore we'd get away. But I always find some excuse to stay. I don't know why I'm stuck here like a stone, just clinging to the only thing I've known. But I wish that I was on that train, sailing across the waves of from the static in my brain. I wish that I was on that train.
That's a beautiful introspective song. I absolutely loved it.
It's sort of written from a man's point of view, kind of. I mm-hmm. think of it more as a man's song in a way. Just the idea of a guy saying, you know, with the narrative is saying, you know, I always wanted it to be different for us. And I don't know, it just sort of seemed that way to me. And it's interesting because Jimmy LaFave just recorded that on his upcoming record. And I thought, perfect.
Yeah. Well, men do seem to have more freedom to take off like that.
Oh, and he's got one of the greatest voices I've ever heard.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you've said about the origin of your songs in an interview that they're all mysteries to me. Did you still feel that way, that the lyrics and the ideas come from a mysterious place?
The music is from a mysterious place. Mm-hmm. The lyrics are hard won. they take me a long time, and it's like, you know, sculpting. I mean, and get out my chisel, and I take as long as it takes to get it right. And that's the hard part for me.
So you write the music first?
The music writes itself first, and then, uh-huh. and that's what I meant when I said mysterious. So I have no idea what makes the tunes come into my head, and the sections, and the, you know, yeah. the refrains, but the lyric I'm quite aware of.
Uh-huh. And you're so much of your stuff is so introspective.
And
that music must become from some almost a lonely place. It feels like. Jude.
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
I think some of us are born lonely, no matter what. You hear people talk about being from a family of 12.
And feeling
like
totally
those Byrne
isolated.
Sisters or something, and they've felt lonely all their lives or something. You know, you often hear that. I think people are just wired that way. You know, mm-hmm. a certain way. And you know, I could be as happy as I've ever been, but I'm still going to write from that lonely place.
Yeah. Well, you can tell, and it's beautiful, and it strikes a chord that so many of us can identify with. So it's universal in many ways.
That's always my hope.
Mm-hmm. You began recording your own songs pretty late in 2002. What was the motivation?
Well, I mean, I'd always wanted to make records, and when I first went out to Los Angeles at 19... all we did was hammer away at trying to get signed by a label.
And in the meantime, people were covering your songs and asking for your songs.
Yeah, but in those days, people didn't have recording studios at home like they do now. People didn't make their own records. You had to uh-huh. sign a big deal with a big label, and it was hard to get. And what's funny now, of course, is like all my friends that were signed are no longer with those labels. They're all making their own records, and it really never did matter very much that they did get signed and I didn't.
Yeah,
I just caught up with them later when it became possible for me to make a record with our own label.
Yeah, and so many artists that I've talked to, like Holly Near and Janice Ian, they much prefer being independents.
Oh, well.
Because those record companies were manipulating people.
Oh, you had
to
answer
something.
To them, you know. And not only did they own you, but they owned your art. I mean, they did manipulate a lot of artists to do styles they had no interest in, and I couldn't have managed with that. There's no way I could have done it.
Yeah. Now, have you ever had anybody cover one of your songs that misinterpreted it? I was wondering about how you feel about some of the interpretation.
Well, I've been really lucky, I have to say. You know, people like Bonnie Raitt and Emmylou Harris are not really going to muck up your song. But occasionally a person will change a lyric or something like that startles me. Because naturally I think that when I write a song, when it's done, it's done, and I don't really intend for someone to change the words.
Absolutely.
And sometimes a person will just, you know, like a stylized, you know, kind of approach.
Yeah,
you know, I'm
going to
style it toward me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not my favorite thing, obviously. But I'm grateful that people do the songs, you know, and I always have to remember that no matter what.
Yeah, I remember Edward Albee, I saw him speak, and he said he would get furious when people would change his lines.
When I first started getting covers, a couple of artists did attempt to do a song where they really wanted to change it, and I said no. Okay. And now I have to tell you, you know, looking back on it now that I'm older and I have a little perspective, and we're all poor, I think twice about that. You know, I would think twice about it now. I mean, then I was
this is my integrity.
Yeah, all about
ways.
Me, you know. Yeah. But now, I certainly wouldn't let somebody do a great deal of changing, you know. But I sort of wish, in hindsight, that I'd said yes to this one artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But things work out the way they're supposed to.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you probably found somebody else to take the place. Now, you have obviously written for a lot of artists. Do you write specific songs for them, or do you write from your own experience and they come and say, I want that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's always the best way to go anyway, because you start aiming, then the radio, you know, starts to sound the same.
Yeah.
Because everybody's aiming for the last week's hit, and I could never approach my art in that way anyway. But in the long run, artists like Trisha, you know, different artists that come to me again and again, they come to me because they know what they're going to get is from the heart.
Uh-huh. And it feels like you've created a sound for her.
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah,
she's
a
tremendous singer.
Kind of an atmosphere. Yeah.
And she, more than any other artist, always does my songs exactly right. Do you know what I mean?
She does them
just like the demo. And I just go, thank you. Because I did it that way on purpose.
If you're just joining us, my guest is singer-songwriter and musician Jude Johnstone. We're discussing her current CD called Quiet Girl. And on that note, I do want to play another excerpt from Quiet Girl. This one's called Cry for New Orleans. It's absolutely heart-wrenching. Tell us about it. I mean,
well, the lyric I co-wrote with a very old close friend named David Lee Carson. And he's more often referred to as Rev Godey.
Oh.
He's a Cherokee Indian sort of medicine man, and he's lived in New Orleans for a long time. I met him in Los Angeles early on, He was sort of hanging out with the crowd, T-Bone Burnett and Steven Souls and some of the old Rolling Thunder Review guys. And those were some of the first people that I sort of hung around in Los Angeles. Not a bad crowd.
Absolutely not.
But Rev Godey is like a poet, kind of a crazy poet with a lot of biblical references and voodoo references. So New Orleans, when he discovered it, was the perfect place for him. And he became very close to Mac Rebennack, Dr. John. And he, in fact, co-wrote that beautiful Grammy-winning album that Dr. John dedicated to Katrina, the city that Care forgot. But when Katrina happened, I hadn't been in touch with Godey for some years. But we had co-written early on. Mm. When I was a kid, and we just had a wonderful simpatico in that way. So he called me on the telephone, and he was crying, and he said, I lost everything but my buffalo robe.
Oh.
And he was really angry and really upset, and I said, just speak, just talk. And so I kind of took notes as fast as I could while he just ranted about his feelings about what had happened. And then I took that information and made it more palatable, and and yet I kept quite a bit of the truth in it, you know.
Well, let's listen to an excerpt from it. God, it's a gorgeous song, Jude. It really is so touching.
Well, you know, the other beautiful thing was that my friends, the Cowsills, had a lot of tragedy in their lives in many ways, but they lost their brother Barry in Katrina. And I had recently gotten back in touch with them and sent them some of the demos, you know, that I was working on for the new record. And they heard Cry from New Orleans, and they said, can we sing on it?
So they're part of the chorus.
I was so touched by that.
Yeah, that is so great.
And it meant the world to me to have them on it, and Godey, people that were truly, truly involved and devastated by what happened there.
Yeah, it's an absolutely gorgeous song. Now, when you write a song like that, are you hoping to facilitate change? Are you hoping to change minds, touch hearts?
Well, you know, I've never written anything like that. You know, I write love songs, and I had never written anything like Cry from New Orleans. But because of what happened and because of my love for David Lee Carson and our friendship, this thing emerged, and that music fell out of me. And I called him back in 20 minutes and had the music to that song, which is, you know, it's actually pretty unwieldy, and it's not typical for me. It's not really a typical piece for me. So something was going on there, I believe, in that phone call. You know, something was happening, and I'm so grateful to have that.
Yeah. God, your songs are so intimate, so that seems to me like it would be just a natural for you to write something like this. Now, do you think the meanings of your songs change when you perform them live in front of audiences?
Well, you know, what I find, and probably most writers do, is that as your life changes, you know, you may have written a song about a certain thing or a certain person, and then years will go by, and you perform it again, and a whole other scenario will happen in your mind just because your life has changed.
That's right.
You know, just like a listener, you know, that enjoys a song will find a whole other meaning in it later in their life when something else has happened.
And you probably go back and go, wow, how did I tap into that when I was 20?
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes I think, wow, what was I thinking? Where did I come up with that idea? I mean, sometimes maybe I'm disappointed, but a lot of times it isn't that way. You do kind of go, geez, I'm glad I thought of that. I wouldn't have thought of that now.
So that's where that stuff's coming from, your unconscious. It has
absolutely.
To be. It has to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, songwriting is obviously not taught in schools, as far as I have ever heard. So
Except at Berklee College of Music.
It's certain schools,
my friend Pat Pattison teaches songwriting there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are some specialized places. But so how important are mentors to songwriters?
Well, for me, it was very important. Mm-hmm. And just listening to music my whole life taught me. The Beatles taught me how to write songs, you know?
I've read in interviews that Yesterday you think of as one of the most perfect songs ever written.
It doesn't hurt to have a voice like that to deliver it either. But that one I certainly wish I'd have written.
Now, I, before we run out of time, I do want to listen to another excerpt from Quiet Girl. This one is called I Don't Want to Go Home. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
I write a lot of songs on my walks, my exercise walks. Mm-hmm. And I Don't Want to Go Home was one of those that I wrote while walking in on the streets of Cambria. And it just came into my head. And it's another lonely song, isn't it?
It is. Uh-huh.
And I got the wonderful Jimmy LaFave to sing it with me.
Uh-huh. Well, let's listen to an excerpt from it.
Everywhere you went with me, wondering where my baby's gone, hanging on your memory. And I know my heart is heating, but I still got this feeling in my bones, and I don't want to go.
Another beautiful song. That's
Thank
all I can
you
say.
So much. Thank you.
Now, a lot of your songs, you're heading out on trains, you don't want to go home. Now, is this from your life at all?
It seems to be some kind of escapism.
Yeah. Are you tapping into something universal, do you think?
I don't know.
Because the truth is, you know, you have a stable life, right? You have two kids and...
You know, yes, I have perhaps a stable outer life. You know, I mean, I always
have... But your inner life is taking off on a train.
I always have inner turmoil. I always have, you know, loneliness, and I'm always reflecting on the past and worrying about the future. I mean, like anybody else, obviously.
But you turn it into beautiful music, which is...
Thank
which
goodness
is
I have...
Something that is a savior for you.
Oh, boy. You know, imagine the amount of money I'm saving on, you know, therapy.
I also wanted to ask you this, too. I've heard some songwriters say that they feel that a song has to grab you immediately in the first, you know, few lines. Do you feel that way as a songwriter? Do you have to grab the listener really fast out of the gate?
No, I don't think of it in those terms. I mean, I don't finish a song unless I think it's a good enough idea that it will come across and they will be pulled in. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm looking to do is pull in the listener with some truth.
Uh-huh.
As long as I can do that and be concise about it, then I feel like I've done my job.
Uh-huh. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you did do a couple of CDs that were sort of blues and jazz tinged. Do you still think of yourself primarily as a folk you know, artist or writer?
I think of myself more as a singer-songwriter jazz artist.
It sounds like Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. I can certainly identify to her path.
Uh-huh.
I applauded her the whole time she was doing all these left turns.
The summer lawns. And
Henry Louis, her longtime engineer producer, was one of my closest friends.
Uh-huh.
And he recorded my first demos with me in Los Angeles and tried desperately to get me signed to A&M Records. Henry only passed a few years ago, and he was the reason that I recorded the Blue Light record, because he always said to me, this is the genre you belong in.
Mm.
And when he died, I said to my manager, I'm making the jazz record now for Henry, and I dedicated it to him.
Wow, that's fascinating, the way you were able to segue. I mean, you seem so comfortable in the folk singer-songwriter genre.
Right, yeah, I suppose so. You know, well, because I listened to so many kinds of music, Jackson Brown and Tom Waits, and you know, but Sarah Vaughan and Nina Simone, and so there was a lot of melding, you know, going on in my writing, and that was one of the reasons the record companies just threw their hands up and said, we don't know who you are, and they gave up. But I had no intention of pigeonholing myself, so I just kept on my merry way and decided to do a jazz record, and then went back to the Americana record on Quiet Girl. My next record is going to be very much the gamut. The next record, I've got 6 or 7 tracks done, and it's a crazy, spooky, weird record.
Really? So you're working on it right now?
Yes.
I want to play another excerpt from Quiet Girl. This one's called Angel at Your Door.
Mm.
And it's one of those songs that feels like it's been around forever.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. That was a song I wrote to myself.
Hmm. Let's listen to an excerpt from it.
There's an angel waiting at your door, and she knows the shape you're in. You can't hide from her anymore. You'd have to sink or swim. I hear you crying in your sleep, and you know it breaks my heart that all these secrets that you keep are tearing us apart. There's an angel waiting at your door. You're gonna have to make a start.
Another beautiful one, June. Oh. I just love your stuff.
Well, thank you so much. A lot of time went into making this record, Quiet Girl, where, for instance, Mr. Sun, the previous record, I recorded live in the studio with all these L.A. jazz guys. So a very different kind of project. And as I said, a lot of pain, a lot of things that friends had, you know, gone through and joined me on the Quiet Girl record. Angel at Your Door is one of those songs that I needed to write to myself, although it sounds like I'm talking to a friend, about change, about rediscovering yourself and getting it together when you feel like you're coming apart.
Well, your music is just absolutely beautiful. Jude Johnstone, thank you so much for joining us. Can you quickly give some contact information?
Yeah, you can reach me and buy the CDs or anything on Bojack Records, B-O-J-A-K, bojackrecords.com.
Okay, great. Well, Jude Johnstone, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for
having
me.
Happy trails.
Okay.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.